Washington. You said he was working as a bartender, Sampson asked.
As far as we knew, Mr. O'Neill said, Tim was saving up for his own place.
And where was that job?
Their eyes went to each other first. Mrs. O'Neill was already in tears.
That's what's so very hard, she said. We don't even know. It was some kind of private club. Timothy had to sign a confidentiality agreement. He said he couldn't tell us anything about it, for his own protection.
Mr. O'Neill picked up for his wife.
We thought he was being a little grandiose at the time, but now I don't know what to believe.
I think he did know what to believe, but it wasn't my job to convince the O'Neills either way. These people were desperate to have their son back. I wasn't going to begrudge them whatever it took to get through a difficult interview with two police detectives. Finally, I asked to see Timothy's room. We followed the two of them back through the kitchen and attached laundry room to what I assumed had once been a maid's quarters. There was a separate entrance from the back hall and a bedroom with its own bathroom, small but with lots of privacy.
We haven't touched anything, Mr. O'Neill said, and then he added almost affectionately, You can see what a slob he was.
My first reaction was that messes are good for hiding things in. The room had as much strewn on the floor as anywhere else. Timothy had never really grown up, had he? There were clothes piled everywhere, on the bed, over the easy chair, on top of the desk. Some of it was just jeans and t-shirts, but there was a lot of expensive-looking stuff, too. The one thing he seemed to keep hung up was a collection of suits and jackets and three leather coats. Two of them were polo, one Hermes. That's where I found the haystack needle. Sampson and I had been sifting for about 15 minutes when I pulled a piece of paper out of one of the blazer pockets. It had a string of 10 letters written on it, like the ones from Caroline's date book. This one said, A-F-I-O-Z-M-B-H-C-P. I held it up for Sampson to see.
Check this out, John.
Mrs. O'Neill stepped back into the room. She'd been waiting outside the door.
What is it? Please tell us.
Could be a phone number, but I'm not sure, I said. I don't suppose Timothy left his cell phone behind.
No, he was attached to that thing 24/7. I mean, who isn't these days?
She tried a weak smile, and I tried one back, but it was hard. All I could think about was how much more likely it had just gotten that she would never see Timothy again.
Chapter 15.
Johnny Tucci had stuck to a rigid system for survival since the trooper car stopped him on I-95. For starters, he never traveled in the same direction for 2 days in a row and never spent more than 24 hours in any one place. In fact, if the skinny girl working the register at the 7-Eleven in Cuttingsville hadn't been such an easy, willing young thing, or if he could even remember the last time he'd gotten laid, he probably would have been long gone by now. Woulda, coulda, shoulda, he was thinking. He was in the middle of his second time around with the register girl when the flimsy door to room 5 at the Parkett Motel opened. Two men in gray suits strolled in like they had a key or something. How the hell had they gotten in the door? Whatever. They were in. Johnny jumped about 3 feet off the bed and pulled the sheet up to cover himself. So did the girl. Liz? Liesel? Johnny Tucci? The Johnny Tucci? One intruder, the speaker, was a white guy, the other Hispanic, maybe Brazilian? Johnny had no clue who they were, but he sure knew why they'd come to the motel. All the same, he gave it his best.
You got the wrong room, man. I never heard of John, whatever you said. Now, please get out!
The Hispanic guy fired before Johnny even saw he had a gun in his hand. He flinched hard and almost had a heart attack on the spot. When he looked, the girl, Liz, Liesel, was sitting cockeyed against the headboard with a hole in her forehead and blood seeping down through the tip of her nose, then onto her breasts.
Jesus Christ!
Johnny fell off the bed more than got off, and then crab-walked himself back into a corner. He'd never actually been shot at before. Let's try this again. Johnny Tucci? Said the white dude. The Johnny Tucci?
Yeah, okay.
He kept his hands up.
one of them at the side of his face so he wouldn't have to see the girl lying there dead and leaking blood. How did you find me? What do you want? Why'd you hurt her? The two guys looked at each other and laughed at his expense. These guys obviously weren't family. They were too white for that, even the dark one. What the hell are you, CIA or something? Worse for you, John. We're former DEA. Less paperwork, if you know what I mean. Johnny was pretty sure he did. They weren't going to write up what had happened to poor Liz or Liesl. What, like she'd tried to pull a gun on them from her pussy? The white guy crossed the floor in a couple of fast steps and kicked him a swift one in the groin. That doesn't mean we like wasting our time running after pathetic garbage like you, though. Let's go. Get your pants on.
I can't. Where are we going?
Johnny was doubled over with his hands on his crotch, only wishing he could hurl. It felt like his stomach had turned inside out.
Just shoot me and get it over with.
Yeah, you'd like that, wouldn't you? Join your little girlfriend in the everlasting. Afraid it's not going to be that easy, my friend. The two guys leaned over and started wrapping him in the motel bedsheet. They pulled the corners up all around, tied them tight. Johnny couldn't even take his hands off his meat to do anything. Then they dragged him out the door like he was a bag of dirty laundry. That's when he would have started screaming if he'd had the air for it, because Johnny Tucci had just figured out where they were going and what was going to happen next.
Chapter 16. When Caroline's mother pulled the black Chevy Suburban into the parking area at Rock Creek Cemetery, it was the first time I'd seen her in over 20 years. We'd spoken on the phone about funeral arrangements, but now that it was here, I didn't know what to expect or really what to say to her. I opened the car door myself. "Michelle, hi." She looked the same to me, still pretty, with the same long, wild hair, shot through with gray now, half-tamed in a braid twisting down her back. It was her eyes that were different. They'd always been so alive. I could see she'd been crying, but they were dry now. Dry, red around the rims, and so very tired.
"I forgot how much you looked like him," she said.
She meant Blake. He and I had always been unmistakably brothers, at least physically, especially in the face. Blake was buried here at Rock Creek, too. I held up my arm and was a little surprised that she took it. We started walking toward St. Paul's, with the rest of the family not far behind. "Michelle, I want you to know that I'm handling Caroline's case myself. If there's anything you need from me..."
"There's not, Alex."
It came out quickly, a simple statement of fact. When she spoke again, her voice started to shake. "I'm going to lay my baby to rest." She stopped to take a steadying breath. "And then I'm going to go back home to Providence. That's as much as I can handle right now."
"You don't have to go through this alone. You can come stay at the house. Nana and I would like that. I know it's been a long time.
A long time since you turned your back on your brother."
So there it was. 20 years of misunderstanding coming out, just like that. Blake's addiction had done a lot of the talking for him near the end. He'd cut me out when I got aggressive about rehab, but that was obviously not what he told Michelle, who was using heroin at the time too, even while she was pregnant with Caroline. "It was actually the other way around," I said to her as gently as I could. For the first time, her voice rose.
"I can't, Alex. I can't go back to that house, so don't ask me to." "Of course you can."
We both turned around. It was Nana who'd spoken. Bree, Janny, and Ali were there too, coming up on either side of Nana, her honor guard, her protectors. Then she walked right up to Michelle and put her arms around her.
"We lost sight of you and Caroline a long time ago. And now we've lost her for good. But you are still a part of our family. You always will be."
Nana stepped back and put a hand on Janny's shoulder.
"Janelle, Ali, this is your Aunt Michelle."
"I'm very sorry for your loss,
Janny said. Nana went on.
Whatever happened before today, or whatever happens tomorrow, doesn't mean a thing right now.
Her voice was filling with emotion, and I could hear shades of the Southern Baptist heritage coming through.
We're here to remember Caroline with all the love we have in our hearts. When those goodbyes are over, then we'll worry about what comes next.
Michelle seemed conflicted. She looked around at each of us, not speaking a word.
So all right then, Nana said.
She patted her chest a few times.
Lord, all this grief has given me an awful feeling. Michelle, take my arm, would you?
I knew Nana's heart was breaking too. Caroline was her granddaughter, though she never really got to know her, and gone forever now. Meanwhile, there was someone else here who needed her help. Maybe that's where I get it, I thought. Sometimes the best or only way to take care of the dead is to take care of the living. Chapter 17. Michelle did go back to her home in Rhode Island that night. I put her on a plane to Providence myself, but I made sure she had my numbers and told her that I hoped we'd hear from her when she was ready. The next morning, I was right back at it, the investigation of her daughter's awful murder and possibly the murders of others. The first thing I tackled at the office was the phone numbers we'd found at Caroline's apartment and in Timothy O'Neill's bedroom. My backup plan was to hit up the bureau for help, but I had a feeling about these numbers. If there was a key to unlocking them, it was probably something that Caroline or Timothy O'Neill could use on a regular basis. I was betting I could do this myself. I started by writing out all the lettered strings I had on a piece of paper, just to get them rolling around in my head. A simple A to Z, 1 through 26 substitution didn't seem right, since anything above J or 10 wouldn't apply to a phone keypad. But what if it came off the keypad itself? I opened my cell on the desk and wrote down what I saw. ABC 2, DEF 3, GHI 4, I equals 1, JKL 5, MNO 6, O equals 0, PQRS 7, TUV 8, WXYZ 9. The 1 and the 0 keys didn't have any letters of their own, of course, but the I and the O seemed like intuitive substitutions. That still left G and H for number 4, and M and N for number 6. When I used that logic to translate the first string, B, G, E, O, G, Z, A, P, M, O, it gave me 243-049-2760. Then I took the first three digits and Googled them as an area code, but 243 came up invalid. It felt too soon to abandon the idea, so I kept going with it. I translated the rest of my list into numbers and lined them all up in a column on the page to see if anything jumped out at me. It sure did. Nearly half the numbers started with a 2. It didn't take long from there to see that all of those numbers had a 0 in the 4th position and another 2 in the 7th. 202 is Washington's area code. I went back to the first number and underlined 243-049-2760. Things were starting to come together. When I looked at the same positions on the non-202 numbers, all but 3 gave me either 703 or 301, which are for areas of Virginia and Maryland close to D.C. The final 3 codes turned out to be from Florida, South Carolina, and Illinois, out-of-town customers, presumably. Again, I went back to the first string. If positions 1, 4, and 7 were an area code, didn't it make sense to look at positions 2, 5, and 8 for the exchange? I started scribbling again. 243
0492760 equals 202. 2430492760 equals 447. 2430492760 equals 3960. 202-447-3960. Next question. Was 447 an actual DC exchange? I grabbed the phone book and found out that it was. This was starting to feel like the first good day of my investigation. A very good day. Once I deciphered everything I had so far, I called a good friend at the phone company, Esperanza Cruz. I knew that the reverse directories we used at work were only good for listed numbers. It took Esperanza maybe 15 seconds to find the first listing.
Okay, now you got me curious, she said. This one is for Ryan Willoughby, unlisted. What's he done, other than being a walking, talking stiff?
I was surprised, but not shocked. Ryan Willoughby was the 6 o'clock anchor for a network TV affiliate here in the Washington area. Esperanza, if you and I were actually having this conversation, I could tell you. But given as how we never spoke today...
Yeah, story of my life, Alex. What's the next number?
In a few minutes, I had a list of 15 names. 6 of them were familiar to me, including a sitting congressman, a professional football player, and the CEO of a high-profile energy consulting firm in town. This thing was starting to bubble over, and not in a good way. When I thought about how these men knew Caroline, it made me sick. Physically ill. My next call was to Bree. She recognized 2 more of the names. One was a partner at Brainerd & Truss, a political PR firm on the Hill, and it turned out that Randy Varick, who was the mayor's press secretary, was a woman.
Things are about to get real nasty around here, Bree said. These are high-resource people, and I'm afraid they're going to push back hard.
Let them push, I said. We'll be ready for him. In fact, I'm going to make my first call right now. In person. Chapter 18. High-resource people, and apparently a lot of them, were involved. What was this about? And how had it led to the death of Caroline Cross? Where else would it lead? It took me less than 15 minutes to get from the Daily building on Indiana up to Channel 9's offices on Wisconsin. By the time I got there, I hadn't cooled down one bit. My badge got me past the guard in the lobby, then up to a receptionist on the 3rd floor. A big number 9 hung on the wall behind her, along with poster-sized headshots of their news team. I showed my badge and pointed at the wall. "I'm looking for him." She pushed a button without taking her eyes off me.
"Judy, I've got a police officer out here for Ryan."
She covered the receiver and spoke to me.
"What is this regarding?"
"Tell him I'll be happy to share that information with anyone who wants to listen if he and I aren't face to face in the next 2 minutes." About 90 seconds later, I was ushered past reception, past the news studio entrance, and into a hall of windowed offices someplace in the back. Ryan Willoughby was waiting for me, looking like his tie was a little too tight. I'd seen him dozens of times delivering the news, but now all that polished blonde congeniality of his was nowhere in sight. "What the hell is this about?" he asked me after he closed the door. "You come barging in here like Elliot Ness or Rudolph Giuliani back in his prosecutor days?" I held up a picture of Caroline. "It's about her," I said in the quietest voice I could manage. It took him a second, but I saw a flash of recognition on his face, then a fast recovery. He was brighter than he seemed. "Pretty girl. Who is she? Are you saying you've never seen her before?" He laughed defensively, and a little more of the anchor speak came into his voice. "Do I need a lawyer here?" "We found your phone number in her apartment. She was murdered." "I'm sorry about that,
the girl's murder. A lot of people have my number, or they can get it. A lot of call girls, I asked. Listen, I don't know what you want with me, but this is obviously some kind of mistake. Whatever he was publicly, this guy was nothing but a scumbag to me now. It was clear he didn't care about Caroline and what had happened to her. She was 24, I said. I held up the picture again. Someone took bites out of her, probably raped her before they killed her. Then they put her body through a wood chipper. We found what was left of her, the remains, in a plastic bag being transported by a mob guy. Why are you telling me this? I don't know this girl. I looked at my watch. I'm going to offer you a deal, Ryan. The terms are good for the next 30 seconds. You tell me how you found out about her right now, and I leave your name out of my investigation, unless, of course, you're guilty of something a lot more damaging than procuring. Is that a threat? 20 seconds. Even if I had any idea what you were talking about, how do I know you are who you say you are? You don't. 15 seconds. Excuse me, detective, but you can go to hell. My hand was cocked, but I caught myself. Willoughby flinched and took a step back. Get out of my office unless you want me to have you thrown out. I waited until the full 30 seconds were up. I'll see you on the news, I said. Trust me, you won't be the one delivering it.
Chapter 19.
20 miles of thick, old-growth Virginia forest separated Remy Williams's cabin from pretty much everything else in the world. It was a pristine bit of wilderness with all the privacy he could ever want. A person could scream all night long out here and never be heard. Not that there ever was much screaming or carrying on out here. Remy appreciated efficiency, and he was good at what he did. Disposal. The thing he didn't like was surprises, like the bright headlights that raked back and forth over his cabin window just after darkness fell that night. In a few seconds, he was out the back door with one of the three Remington 870 shotguns he kept around for exactly this reason, uninvited visitors. He hustled over to the side of the cabin and took up a position with a perfect view of the dark-colored sedan that was just coming to a stop out front. He saw that the vehicle was a Pontiac, either black or dark blue. Two men got out. Anybody home? One of them called. The voice was familiar, but Remy kept the Remington on his hip anyway. What are you doing out here? He yelled to them. Nobody called ahead. Their shadows turned toward him in the dark. Relax, Remy. We found him. Alive? At the moment. Remy slowly came around to the porch and traded the shotgun for a battery-powered lantern, which he lit. What about the other one, the girl who ran off? Still working on it, said the cocky one, the white guy. Remy didn't know either of their names and didn't want to. He knew the Spick was the smart one, though, and the most dangerous. Silent but deadly all the way. He walked to the back of the car and thumped on the trunk with his lantern. Pop it.
Chapter 20.
The young punk inside was naked as a newborn, half wrapped in a soiled bedsheet with a double dose of duct tape twisted across his mouth. As soon as he laid eyes on Remy, he started scrambling around like there was somewhere inside that trunk he could go and hide. Why in hell's he not wearing anything? What's the point in that? He was banging some girl when we found him. And she's been taken care of. Ah, you should have brought her to me for safekeeping, too. Remy turned back to the kid who'd gone still again, except for the eyes. Those never stopped moving. Ah, he's a funny little gerbil, isn't he? He reached down and pulled the boy up, then spun him around so the punk could see the 20-year-old wood chipper in the car's headlights. Now, you know why you're here, so I won't quibble on the details, he said. I just need to know one thing from you, and I want you to think real careful about this. You ever tell anyone about this place? Anyone at all? The kid shook his head way more than he needed to. No. Are you real sure about that, son? You wouldn't lie to me, especially now. The head changed direction and went, yes. Remy laughed out loud,
You see that? He looks like one of those stupid bobbleheads for your dashboard. He bent his knees to be face to face with the kid and palmed his skull. Then he started rocking it up and down and side to side, laughing the whole time. Yes, yes, yes. No, no, no. Yes, yes, yes. Then, just as fast, he twisted the head halfway round with a crisp snap and let the boy fall to the ground like a broken toy. That's it? Break his neck? One of the other two asked. That's what we wanted him alive for? Oh, it's just fine, Remy told them, pushing the accent a little. I got an intuition about this stuff. They both shook their heads like he was some ignorant redneck, which Remy took as a compliment to his acting abilities. Hey, you fellas want to stick around for a drink? I got some good stuff out back. We got to keep moving, said the dark-skinned ghost. Thanks for the offer. Maybe some other time, Denny. Suit yourself. No problema. In truth, there wasn't a drop of alcohol anywhere on the property. The only thing Remy drank besides bottled water, which he bought by the case, was the sun-brewed iced tea he sometimes made from it. Alcohol was poison to the system. He just liked letting these sanctimonious pricks think what they wanted to think about him anyway. They were typical government issue, those two, the way they saw everything and nothing at the same time. If they looked a little closer, they'd know when they were being tested and what they were up against. One other thing, he added. No more pickups. He prodded the dead boy with his foot. That pot ain't been working out so well, you know. I'll do the disposal, starting with him. Agreed. He's all yours. They drove off without even a goodbye wave. Remy waved. Then he waited until he couldn't hear the car anymore and got to work. The kid was just skin and bones, and it didn't take any more cutting to get him ready than it would have for a girl. Two at the knees, two at the hips, two at the shoulders, one at the neck. Then one long swipe down the middle of his skinny little torso. It was messier with the knife than it might have been with a chainsaw or an axe, but Remy liked wet work. Always had. Once that was done, it took only about 10 minutes to get the Philly flash through the machine and into a plastic bag. It was amazing how light the bags always felt, as if it was something more than just foam and residue that got left behind inside the chipper. He took a shovel and a flashlight from the cabin and threw the bag into a wheelbarrow. Then he started walking into the woods. Didn't matter which way. Wherever this kid landed, he was going to disappear forever. Never to be seen or heard from again, Remy muttered to himself. He bobbled his head up and down and side to side as he walked and started to laugh. No, 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 never. No, 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 no.
Chapter 21. A loud noise woke me in the middle of the night. Something had fallen and broken downstairs. I was almost sure of it. I looked at the clock, saw it was just after 4:30. Did you hear that? Bree raised her head off the pillow.
Hear what? I just woke up. If I'm awake.
I was already out of bed and pulling on a pair of sweats.
Alex, what is it?
I don't know yet. I'll go see. I'll be right back. Everything seemed quiet from where I stopped to listen in the middle of the stairs. I could just see the sky going to blue outside, but it was still dark in the house. Nana? I called in a voice barely louder than a whisper. There was no answer. Bree was up now, too, and at the top of the stairs, only a few feet away.
I'm right here.
When I came down into the front hallway, I could see straight back into the kitchen. The refrigerator door was open, and there was just enough light from it that I could see Nana lying on the floor. She wasn't moving. Bree, call 911. Chapter 22. Nana lay there on her side, in her favorite old robe and slippers. The pieces of a mixing bowl were on the floor around her, and her face was contorted, as if she'd been in terrible pain when she fell. Nana, can you hear me? I said as I hurried into the kitchen. I knelt down and felt for her pulse. It was weak, but it was there. My own was spiking like crazy. Please, no.
Not now. Not like this.
Alex, here.
Bree ran in and handed me the phone. 911, what is your emergency? My grandmother's just collapsed. I found her unconscious on the floor. My eyes scanned her face, her arms, her legs. There's no sign of injury, but I don't know what happened before her fall. Her pulse is very weak. Bree started timing Nana's pulse off the kitchen clock while the operator took my name and address. Sir, I'm dispatching an ambulance to your house right now. The first thing you want to do is make sure she's still breathing, but try not to move her. It's possible she injured her spine when she fell. I understand. I won't move her. Let me check. Nana's face was angled toward the floor. I leaned down and held the back of my hand to her mouth. At first, it seemed like forever. There was nothing, but then I felt a faint movement of air. She's breathing, but barely, I said into the phone. A soft rattle came from Nana's chest. Please hurry. I think she's dying. Chapter 23. Dispatch talked me through something called a modified jaw thrust to help open Nana's airway. It was all nightmarish and surreal in the worst way I could imagine. I took hold of the curved part of her jaw and pushed it forward and up, using my thumb to keep her lips open. Her breathing picked up, but only slightly, and not a regular cadence. Then Ali's voice came from behind me, soft and scared.
Why is Nana on the ground like that? Daddy, what happened to her?
He was standing in the kitchen door, holding onto the frame as if he didn't want to be pushed any further into the room than that. Bree put a hand over mine on Nana's cheek.
I've got her, she said,
and I went to talk to Ali. Nana's sick, and she fell down. That's all it is, I told him. An ambulance is going to come and take her to the hospital.
Is she going to die?
Ali asked, and tears flooded his gentle eyes. I didn't answer, but I kept my arms around him, and we stood in the doorway to the kitchen. The one thing I couldn't do right now was leave Nana. We're going to stay right here, and we're going to think about how much we love Nana, okay? Ali nodded slowly without taking his eyes off her.
Daddy?
I turned and saw Janny in the hall. She was even more shocked and wide-eyed than her brother. I motioned her over, and we all waited together for the ambulance to arrive. Finally, we heard a low siren outside. In a strange way, it seemed to make everything worse. Once the EMTs got there, they took Nana's vitals and started her on oxygen. What's her name? One of them asked. Regina. The word almost stuck in my throat. Nana's name means queen, of course, and that's what she is to us. Regina? Can you hear me? The tech pushed a knuckle into her sternum, and she didn't move. No pain response. Let's get a heart rhythm. They asked me a few more questions while they worked. Was she on medication? Had her condition changed since we called 911? Was there any history of heart trouble with her or in the family? I kept a hand on Ali the whole time to let him know I was there, but vice versa too. Janny stayed right by my side as well. Within minutes, the EMTs had started a saline lock. Then they slid a collar around Nana's neck and put a backboard under her. Janny finally buried her face in my side, sobbing quietly. That got Ali crying again, and Bree too. We're a mess, I finally managed. That's why she can't leave us. They lifted Nana's tiny body onto a stretcher, and we followed them through the dining and living rooms, then out the front door. The familiarity of the surroundings seemed both sad and scary. Bree had disappeared for a minute, and now she came up from behind, handing me my cell, a shirt, and a pair of shoes. Then she took Ali from me and put an arm around Janny. Their faces were like mirrors of everything I was feeling. Go with Nana, Alex. We'll follow you in the car. Chapter 24.
Gabe Reese was pacing with his arms folded tightly just inside the West Wing lobby doors. He wasn't used to this kind of uncertainty, this total lack of information, the fucking mystery of it all. He had plenty of resources at his disposal. He just couldn't use most of them on this. Not until he was sure what they were dealing with. He was waiting for the vice president, and the subject was Zeus, of course, and what had been found out so far, and what kind of unprecedented scandal this could turn out to be. Tillman was scheduled to address the National Association of Small Business Owners from 12:30 to 1 at the convention center. It was less than a mile and a half away, which meant maybe 5 minutes in the car. Reese was going to need every second. At exactly 12:20, the vice president strode into the lobby with the Secret Service's Dan Cormorant on one side and a deputy director of communications on the other. Two scheduling assistants and another Secret Service agent trailed behind, the usual kind of entourage, trappings of power and arrogance. Tillman looked surprised to see Reese standing there, holding his trademark fedora in one hand.
"Gabe, you're coming to this thing?"
"Yes, sir, wouldn't miss it. Not a word. Not an arching eyebrow."
"Okay, okay. Let's go, then."
They continued outside where the vice president's Cadillac limo, two black Suburbans, and three motorcycle police waited with engines running. As the vice president stepped into his car, Reese put a hand on Cormorant's shoulder.
"We need some privacy, Dan."
The senior agent squinted in annoyance, then turned to his number two.
"Bender, take the staff car. I've got this covered."
"Yes, sir."
"You know that has to go into the log," Cormorant said as soon as the other agent was out of earshot.
"No, it doesn't," Reese told him. There was more than enough precedent for this kind of request, even from Reese himself. Once Reese and the vice president were in the car, Cormorant got in. Then he radioed the go-ahead, and the motorcade pulled out toward 15th Street.
Chapter 25.
With a partition up and tinted bullet and soundproof glass on all sides, this was as private a meeting as they were going to get today, given the vice president's busy schedule. Reese took a quick breath, then he started right in on what he'd found out. For one thing, the FBI and Metro Police were both pursuing the case, at least as a murder investigation. Apparently prostitutes were involved, male and female. Zeus hadn't been identified yet, if there actually was a Zeus. "I've just heard that we've got another problem." He turned to face the Secret Service agent on the jump seat.
"Dan, do you know who Alex Cross is?"
"MPD detective. Specializes in major cases. Homicides. Serials."
"He's working on a certain murder in question?"
Cormoran hadn't missed a beat.
"We're aware of Cross's involvement. We're watching him."
"And I'm finding out about this on my own. Why?" Cormoran ticked off the vice president's wishes on two fingers. "No phone? No email, remember? I'll get information to you when I can get it to you, Gabe. We're talking about one homicide detective here."
"Hang on," the vice president cut in. "Where are we on Zeus, Dan?"
"Quickly, please," Reese added. They were already coming up on K Street, which was less crowded than usual, unfortunately.
"It's complicated. There are a lot of avenues to go down. We've had some SIGINT on a private club out in Virginia. Very discreet place for meetings. It's a sex club, sir. It's possible that Zeus has been there. It's likely he has. The White House, actually the Cabinet, keeps coming up, but that might be because of the code name Zeus. I hope it's no more than that."
Tillman's expression darkened as he leaned in toward the Secret Service man.
"And that's it? That's all you have?"
"This is a murder investigation. They usually don't solve themselves. The club is called Blacksmith Farms. We have the names of several clients. The owners are mob."
Tillman snapped. "Why can't we find out who Zeus is?"
"I'm sorry, sir, but I can't turn over too many rocks without attracting more attention than we want. We're not even sure if Zeus actually used the club in question. There are all these swirling rumors, but nothing solid."
Reese didn't like Cormorant's tone with the vice president any more than he did with himself. "Swirling rumors? Who else knows about this?" he asked.
"Two senior agents in the Joint Operations Center, one intelligence officer, but it's all being contained. No links to the OVP at all."
Cormorant gave Reese another one of his squints. "You need to calm down. It's not helping. We're moving as fast as we can, and there's lots to check. The circumstances couldn't be worse."
The words "fuck you" ran through Reese's mind, but he was too savvy to lose it in front of Tillman. Still, this situation had the makings of one of the biggest bombshells to hit Washington in years. A serial killer involved with the Cabinet, or attached to the White House?
Sir, I'm going to recommend you designate all Secret Service logs from your detail as sensitive compartmented information until further notice. Sir, any SCI order puts your thumbprint right where you don't want it, Cormorant interjected, but simultaneously puts that information completely out of reach, Reese answered back. Tillman had the authority to bypass not just the White House Security Office on this one, but the Freedom of Information Act.
Okay, Tillman nodded agreement with the Chief of Staff. It was done. Then he asked, what about this detective, Cross? How worried do we need to be about him?
Cormorant thought for a moment. It's hard to know until he turns something up. If he does, I'm keeping my eye on it, and if anything changes at all, I'll update you.
Not me, Tillman said firmly. Go through Gabe. Everything goes through Gabe from now on.
Of course.
Reese found he was repeatedly running a hand through his hair without even realizing it. They were just arriving at the convention center. The pressure was on to wrap this discussion up somehow. Quickly, he said, anything else I should know? Anything else that you've been keeping to yourself, like who the hell Zeus is?
Cormorant's face reddened, but all he said was, we're here, sir.
Chapter 26. Nana was alive. That's what mattered. It was all I cared about right now. But I did wonder why it was that when you lose someone, or are about to lose someone important to you, they become more precious than ever. It was hell waiting for her to come back from tests at the hospital. I had to sit for hours in a sterile, fluorescent-lit corridor, while my mind ran through every possible worst-case scenario, a bad habit of mine from work. I tried to fill my head with memories of Nana, going all the way back to when I was 10 and she had replaced my parents in my life. When they finally wheeled her out, it was a gift just to look into her eyes. She'd been unconscious when we arrived, and there had been no guarantee I would ever see her alive again. But here she was, and she was talking.
Gave you a little scare there, did I?
Her voice was weak and wheezy, and she looked even tinier than usual sitting up on the gurney, but she was alert. More than a little scare, I said. It was all I could do to keep from squeezing the life back out of her. I settled for a lingering kiss on the cheek. Welcome back, old woman, I whispered in her ear, just to make her smile, which it did.
Good to be back. Now, let's get out of here.
Chapter 27. Once we got Nana settled in a hospital bed, the cardiologist on call came to meet with us. Her name was Dr. Engelfield, and she looked about 50, with a compassionate face, but also the kind of professional detachment I've seen with a lot of specialists. She worked off Nana's chart while she spoke.
Mrs. Cross, your general diagnosis is congestive heart failure. Specifically, your heart isn't pumping enough blood into your system. That means you're not getting enough oxygen or nutrients, and that's most likely why you collapsed this morning.
Nana nodded, not showing any emotion. The first thing she asked was,
how soon can I leave the hospital? The average day for something like this is 4 or 5 days. I'd like to adjust your blood pressure medication and see where we are in a few days. Oh, I'll be at home, doctor. Where will you be?
Engelfield laughed politely, as if she thought Nana was joking. As soon as she was gone, though, Nana turned to me.
You need to speak with someone else, Alex. I'm ready to go home.
Is that so? I asked, trying to keep it light.
Yes, that's so.
She wagged her hand, trying to shoo me out of the room.
Go on, make it happen.
This was starting to get uncomfortable for me. I'd never called any shots for Nana before, and now suddenly I had to do just that. I think we should go with the doctor on this one, I said. If a few nights in the hospital means we don't have to repeat this morning, then I'm all for it.
You're not listening to me, Alex.
Her voice had changed in a beat, and she grabbed my wrist.
I'm not going to spend another day in a hospital bed. Do you hear me? I refuse. It's my right to do so. Nana, no.
She let go and pointed at me with a shaking finger.
I will not have that tone either. Now, are you going to respect my wishes or not? I'll get right up and do it myself if I have to. You know I will, Alex.
It was an awful feeling, standing there on the other end of that finger of hers. Nana was insisting, but she was also pleading with me to listen to her wishes. I sat down on the edge of the bed and leaned in so that my head was right next to hers. When I spoke, it was with my eyes closed. Nana, I need for you to get serious about this recovery. Slow down a few miles an hour here and there and let this happen. You must, so be smart. The latter was something that Nana had been saying to me since I was 10 years old. Be smart. It was totally quiet in the room except for the sound of her leaning back against the pillow. When I opened my eyes, there were tears on her cheeks.
That's it then? This is where I die?
I pulled up a chair and sat down next to the bed. Later, I'd sleep in that same chair. Nobody's dying in here tonight, I said.
Part 2. Fire with Fire. Chapter 28.
Tony Nicholson was already anxious enough, crazed, actually, and now he was running late thanks to an overturned tractor trailer on the way out of the city. By the time he reached Blacksmith Farms, it was just after 9:30, and his important guests were due in less than half an hour, including a very special guest. He stayed in his car and buzzed. Yes, a woman's voice answered. Cultured, British, his assistant, Mary Claire.
It's me, MC.
Good evening, Mr. Nicholson. You're a bit late. No shit, Sherlock, Nicholson thought, but didn't say out loud. The gate swung open and closed again behind his Cayman S as he pulled in. The long driveway cut across nearly a mile of open field, then through a swath of forest, mostly hickory and oak, before coming out in view of the main house. Nicholson parked his Cayman in the old carriage barn and came in through the patio French doors.
I'm here, sorry.
His hostess for the evening, a Trinidadian beauty by the name of Esther, was arranging leather guest folios on a Chippendale table in the foyer.
Any issues for me? He asked. Any unanticipated problems for tonight?
None, Mr. Nicholson. Everything is perfect. Esther had a wonderfully serene manner that Nicholson loved. It slowed him down right away.
The Bollinger is iced. We have the Flor de Farac coronas in the humidors. The girls are all beautiful and properly briefed. And you have,
she pulled a watch out of her pocket, there were no clocks in the house,
at least 20 minutes before our first guests are scheduled to arrive. They called ahead. They are right on time. They sound very enthusiastic. Right then, excellent job. You know where to find me if you need me.
Nicholson made a quick pass through the first floor before heading upstairs. The foyer and lounges on this level evoked an English gentleman's club more than anything, with their mahogany paneling, brass fixtures on the bars, and lots of ridiculously expensive antiques. It looked like the kind of place his father could have only dreamed of joining, given England's obscene class system. Nicholson was a working-class Brighton boy by birth, but he left all of that dreary shit behind long ago. Here, he was king, or at least a crown prince. He took the main stairs up to the second floor, where several of the girls were already dressed and waiting for the first rush of guests. The early buggers. Stunningly beautiful girls, elegant and sexy. They sat chatting on the low sofas in the mezzanine, which also had comfortable floor cushions all around and layers of soft drapes that could be pulled for more or less privacy, depending on the desires of the party.
Evening, ladies, he said, looking them over with an expert eye. Yes, yes, very nice. Oh, you're gorgeous, perfect, all of you, in every way.
Thank you, Tony, one of them said a little louder than the rest. This was Catherine, of course, whose gray-blue eyes always lingered over his Nordic features a little longer than the others. She would have loved to have a go at the boss, and for all the wrong reasons he understood. Like replacing his wife in his life. Nicholson leaned down to whisper in her ear, fingering the hem of her white lace mini as he did.
Different dress, though, I think, Cat. Can't have the horse looking like horse now, can we? He watched the beautiful girl struggle to keep the brilliant smile on her face, as if he'd just said something charming and sweet. Without another word, she got up and left the room. "I have to use the little girl's room," she whispered. Once he'd been satisfied that everything else was in superb working order, Nicholson continued up to his locked office on the third floor. This was the one area of the house he kept off limits to both the guests and the help. Inside, he poured a glass of $700-a-bottle Bollinger, a gift to himself from the client's stock, and sat down. It had been a hectic day. Now he could finally relax. Well, not really relax, but at least there was the Bollinger. Two large flat-screen monitors dominated the desk in front of him. He powered up the system and typed in a long password. Rows of thumbnail images tiled open like dominoes across one of the two screens. At first glance, they looked like miniature still lifes, each one from a different area of the house. Foyer, mezzanine, guest suites, massage rooms, dungeon, screening rooms. There were 36 in all. Nicholson stopped for just a moment to watch the duplicitous Catherine in one of the changing rooms, wearing just a thong, breasts heaving, fussing at her runny eye makeup in the mirror. Beautiful though she might be, Catherine was a mistake. Too ambitious, too cunning. But she was not his real priority right now. He clicked on an image of the driveway in front of the house and dragged it so that it jumped screens to open full size on the other monitor. A time signature began to count out at the bottom. He clicked once more on a red triangular button in the border for record. The first cars were just pulling in. The party was about to start. "Let the fucking begin, mind and otherwise. Whatever their little hard-ons desire."
Chapter 29.
By 11:30, the very expensive and exclusive Blacksmith Farms was in full swing. Each of the guest suites was occupied. The massage rooms, the dungeon, even the mezzanine was hopping with hot sex and related shenanigans. Girl-boy, girl-girl, boy-boy, girl-boy-girl, whatever the customer wished. The entire house had been booked for a bachelor party that evening. 5 pretty boy escorts, 34 girls, 21 very horny guests, a $150,000 fee already transferred into the club's numbered account. The host and best man was well known to Nicholson. He was Temple Souter, a partner with one of D.C.'s most prestigious and well-connected law firms, with clients including the Family Research Council and the Royal Family of Saudi Arabia, as well as members of the former White House administration. Nicholson had done his homework, as always. Benjamin Painter, the Bachelor of Honor, was about to marry into one of Washington's dynasty families. Next week, he'd be calling the senior senator from Virginia Dad, and one of D.C.'s most beloved plastic surgery victims, Mom. He was also widely believed to be gearing up for a Senate run of his own, all of which made Mr. Painter quite valuable, in Nicholson's way of viewing the world anyway. Right now, the future groom and senator was sprawled on a club chair in Suite A. Two of the youngest, prettiest, and least threatening girls, Sasha and Liz, were slowly undressing each other on the bed while a new one, Anna, worked him over through the cotton of his yuppie boxers. The threesome looked to be in their mid-teens, but all were of legal age, 19 to be exact, barely legal. Nicholson ran a finger across his touchpad to adjust the image. The cameras were wireless pan-tilt zoom units the size of pencil erasers. This particular one was embedded in the room's smoke detector. A microphone no bigger than a match head was hardwired through the ceiling and into the chandelier directly over the king-size bed, where Sasha was just sitting up, smiling blithely, cooing. She straddled Liz, both of them naked now, except for expensive-looking costume jewelry, their slinky black cocktail dresses in tiny heaps on the floor. Sasha reached across to the nightstand, opened the drawer, and pulled out a thick, flesh-colored phallus. She held it up and waggled it for Benjamin Painter to see. His eyes widened appropriately. "Would you like me to do Liz?" she asked, smiling demurely. "I'd like to do Liz. I'd really like to do Liz." "That's great," Ben said, as if praising a useful underling at his father's firm. "Get her ready for me, Sasha. And you," he put his hand on top of Anna's head as she knelt in front of him, "you just take your time, Anna. Slow and steady wins the race, am I right?" Oh, I wouldn't have it any other way, Benjamin. I'm enjoying this, too.
If Mr. Painter was busy giving Nicholson excellent video material to work with, his good friend from their days together at NYU Law, Mr. Souter, was all but writing a blank check. Souter had two of the prettiest Asian girls, Maya and Justine, in the spa. Maya was lying across the tiled soaking tub platform, on her back, with her small, shapely legs wiggling in the air, while Souter drilled her furiously. She seemed to be enjoying it, which was doubtful since Maya and Justine lived together and were a couple, recently married in their home state of Massachusetts. Justine, in fact, was just now providing the money shot. She stood over Souter, knees slightly bent, gripping a hold bar on the ceiling, and letting nature take its course down the client's shoulders and back. Souter panted out in time with his own thrusts, his voice rising toward climax.
That's right. That's right. That's a girl. That's a fucking girl.
Nicholson rolled his eyes in disgust and muted the mating sounds. He didn't need to hear this idiot's twaddle right now. Later in the week, he'd pick out a nice 30-second clip to send to Mr. Souter at his home office. Something with full frontal and choice words always seemed to do the job best. Because as much as these men were willing to pay for getting spanked on a Saturday night, or even just to fuck a woman who wouldn't ask what they were thinking about afterward, Tony Nicholson knew that they were always, always willing to pay even more for the privilege of keeping those dirty little secrets to themselves. All of them, except Zeus.
Chapter 30.
What have you got?
License DLY-224, a dark blue Mercedes McLaren leased to a temple suitor.
The lawyer?
Presumably. Who else would it be? Guy's got more money than God.
Carl Vilanovich put the camera down and rubbed his eyes vigorously. It had been three straight nights of surveillance in the woods of Blacksmith Farms, and he was stone cold sick of the duty. He unfolded a tripod from his pack and mounted the camera to give himself a break. The image played on a laptop next to him as he zoomed out for a long shot of the house exterior. The place was huge, limestone from the look of it, with three-story columns in front. It had probably been a plantation house at one point. There was a converted barn in the back and several other outbuildings, all of them dark tonight.
Hey, here comes another one.
His partner Tommy Scuba fired off several shots with a high-speed digital SLR as a wine-red Jaguar coupe came rushing out of the woods. Vilanovich went in tight on the Jag's license number when it swung around the oval loop in front of the house.
Got that? He asked.
Got it, came the voice on his headset.
Command center was 75 miles away in Washington, watching everything in real time. There was no valet out front. The new arrival parked himself and rang the bell. Almost instantly, a tall, gorgeous black woman in a shimmery dress answered the door, smiling, and let him right in.
Scuba, stay on the windows.
I know, doing my best to make Steven Spielberg proud. Jaguar must be a regular.
Vilanovich rubbed both hands up and down his face, trying to stay sharp.
Any chance of calling this early tonight? We've already got more than we need here, don't we?
Negative, command came back right away. We want you there for departures.
Another round of shots from Scuba's camera pulled Vilanovich's attention back to the house. The Jag's driver had just passed a window on the stairs, walking with a girl on his arm. Tall and black, but not the woman from the front door.
Jesus Christ, Scuba lowered the camera and muted his headset. Do you see the rack on her? I don't mind saying, I'm a little jealous out here, and, horny.
Don't be. Quantico's on the case now, Vilanovich told him, still watching the empty window. When this place goes down, they are all going down with it.
Chapter 31. Before Nana was allowed to come home, I had to meet with Dr. Englefield one more time. In the confines of her office on the first floor at St. Anthony's, the doctor was considerably more relaxed and easygoing and human. We've unloaded the fluid in your grandmother's chest and gotten her blood pressure back to a baseline level, but that's only a start. She and you are going to have to be vigilant. Regina won't admit it, but she's over 90 years old. This is a serious problem. I understand, I said, and so does my grandmother, believe it or not. Nana was already on a new regimen of medications, ACE inhibitors, diuretics, and a hydralazine nitrate combination that had been shown especially effective with African-American patients for some reason. There was also a new no-salt diet to think about, and daily weight monitoring to make sure she wasn't retaining excess fluid. "It's a lot to get used to all at once," Dr. Ingefield said, offering a rare half-smile. "Lack of compliance is a major contributor to cardiac arrest for someone in her position, and family support is crucial. It's critical." "Believe me, we'll do whatever it takes," I told her. Even Jenny had been researching congestive heart failure online. "I'd also recommend bringing in a home care provider anytime you and your wife are out of the house." Engelfield had met Bree only once in passing. I didn't bother to correct her. "Of course, that might be a tough sell with your grandmother,